cases where people would be meditating, sitting in meditation, and they would have an image of reptilian eyes appear before them, and they'd get some kind of a communication, and sometimes actually a sort of a friendly feeling from them. And then I came across cases where people would encounter a reptilian and feel overwhelming feelings of love coming from the reptilian. So I found that what I started out thinking, you know, and I always wanted to give the reptilians the benefit of the doubt because I have a pet snake and I love reptiles. So, you know, I was happy to see that, okay, well, even though the early report seemed to be mostly of the negative variety, since then I've gotten a lot more positive reports. And on Facebook, my friend Bridget Smith, who is a reptilian contactee, and Lindsay Meehan and myself and Erica Getch was involved for a while, who's encountered these blue beings that seem to be some form of reptilian. We got together and created a page called Positive Reptilian Contact to emphasize the positive aspect of the reptilian-human contact experience.
So it seems to be a mixed bag. And I guess, you know, that's what I've experienced too. And, you know, talking to a lot of people, it is a mixed bag. I guess just like here in our density and our experience here on Earth, it's a mixed bag as well with a bit of everything going on. With the research you've done, and we'll move on from the reptilian thing in a moment, but with the reptilian side of things, have you had any information or stories on the nature of where they're from and what's going on and why they're interacting at all? Like anything along those lines?
The first case I had of someone with a physical contact with a reptilian, it's actually the first contactee I met and talked to, was Garnet Doonan. And that was, I met her in 1991, and her reptilian experience involved being in an underground base, probably somewhere off the coast of Washington State here, and she has a familiar being who's a luminous being, actually emits light through her skin who levitates. It seems to be a very spiritually advanced being. She calls Astartlia. And Astartlia looks like a hybrid, but she does have the vertical slit pupils, indicating there's at least something cat-like, if not reptilian, about her. But Garnet was at this base, and she had gone off somehow by herself. Like, I guess sometimes people actually report they're just allowed to wander about a craft or a base. And Garnet was looked up ahead of her, and she was in this area, and ahead there was this room being guarded by a very muscular reptilian being with the sort of bumpy scales and a thick plastron or breastplate on the chest. As Garnet started to walk towards that room, the reptilian moved into a deep crouch and turned toward her, and it was like a message, like, don't get any closer or you might be mauled. But this is an example of a reptilian serving as a guard, and when it has that duty as a guard, it's very much, that's its duty, and it's going to do that, and it's going to protect that room from anyone who tries to get in there who's not authorized. But that's an example of a reptilian at an underground base, and I've met other people who've described reptilian in sort of underground situations. Presumably, there are bases here on Earth with reptilians, and they are somewhere in the crust of the Earth. The crust is actually fairly thick, and I imagine with alien technology, you could probably build a base where the temperature and the environment is all controlled and the air is recycled and so forth. So you could have a situation down there where, you know, you could have a base that might be sustained for thousands of years. And, you know, one of the theories about the reptilians is that they actually evolved here on Earth in the distant past, possibly during the dinosaur era. And this is something that some of the reptilians have told people is the case. Other cases people have been told that these reptilians are actually from other planets in the galaxy, or possibly other dimensions or something like that. So if you look for a theory as to the reptilian origins, you get multiple stories coming, you know, and not really consistent, but at the same time, if you remember, there are multiple races of reptilians that might account for it.
Definitely. Have you come across much stuff between the reptilian side and the government? Like, you talked about the underground bases scenario where there are so many reports going back. I think even Jordan Maxwell and something long ago talked about how there was some guy and his daughter had an experience where he was in the house, so there was almost like this over-watching scenario of, you know, a reptilian on somebody in the government. And then we hear a lot of reports of the reptilians having a connection, or, you know, different facets of the reptilian races having connections to the government. Is there sort of anything along those lines besides the underground basis scenario that you've had?
Well, that definitely I've come across cases, not too many, but a few cases in which there seemed to be interaction between human military and reptilians. Misha Johnston, who's been very public, she runs a support group out of Las Vegas, and she's had benevolent contacts with the reptilian she calls Ayano, and she's had not so nice contacts with another reptilian race that calls itself the Chukara. And the Chukara seem to be working with some faction of human military. But most of those experiences have actually taken place underground. I mean, the Chukara might show up in her bedroom and abduct her, and then she ends up in an underground situation where there's Chukara and military together. There was a situation, this gets into the MILAB aspect, which stands for military abduction, which, you know, Melinda Leslie's, Melinda Leslie is one of the best researchers on this. She's a MILAB experiencer, and she's been researching this phenomenon since the mid-90s, when she began to realize it was happening to her, as well as the alien abduction experience. But Melinda and Misha were staying together in the year 2000 at Misha's apartment in San Diego, and they were abducted in the middle of the night, maybe around 2 a.m., from the apartment by human military wearing kind of black ops and, you know, kind of those, whatever they wear when they abduct someone secretively in the middle of the night. And one guy stood at the door with kind of a communications, like a headset or something, and he was talking to people in this van, and they put Misha and Melinda in the back of the van, and they drugged them with like an injection of some kind. They took them to a base in Southern California there, and in the base they both were taken into separate rooms and told to stop. Because at the time, they were working on a website called militaryabductions.com, and they were each separately basically interrogated and bullied and told to stop working on this book you were doing together. And they each had an encounter with the reptilian who was working with the military. For instance, in Melinda's situation, she recalls the military man who was talking to her said, there's someone I'd like you to meet. And then this large muscular reptilian walks into the room, and the military man walks out. And in each of their situations, the reptilian comes in really close to them and implants an image or a vision, actually a full-fledged experience in their mind of a very traumatic situation. In Melinda's case, it was seeing herself being attacked and mutilated, and Misha's, it was seeing her family attacked. But then they realized partway through that, wait a minute, this isn't right. you know, there's no pain or there's no sound or something's missing, and they realize, oh, this is just a virtual reality scenario, and they snap out of it. And at that point, the reptilian pulls back and realizes, okay, the illusion is breaking, and the reptilian leaves the room. But that's a situation where this particular reptilian, and there's some debates as to whether they each saw the same reptilian or a different one, because they each described it differently when I interviewed them separately in 2012. But the general features of the face were similar, but the coloration and certain details like that were different. But that particular reptilian does seem to be working with human military or covert ops that have some work with military intelligence or something, because they were using an actual military base in Southern California for that situation.
So have you come across anything in terms of, you know, similar to what David Icke's reported? You know, he's talked to, I think it was a confidant of Princess Diana's, talking about, you know, the reptilians and the royal family, this sort of thing. Anything to do with politicians or government, as far as it is, have you personally talked to anybody that says, you know, to them it's basically some of that would be fact?
I've never met anyone who's seen a political figure shapeshift or anything like that. I've met a lot of people who believe that that's going on, but... or who say they've seen it in YouTube videos or something, yes. Although in a lot of the cases...
Pixelation
and light shining on your eyeballs in a strange way or something like that. I've met people who've seen, a friend or a lover who they accept as a reptilian starseed, and they've seen that person's face momentarily shapeshift into a reptilian face. But that's not a situation where they feel that the person is being infiltrated or something like that. They actually feel that that's just another facet of that person's soul from a parallel life or a past life or a future life or something like that. And so I've met people who've had that sort of, probably not a physical shape-shifting, but more like seeing them through different eyes or through your third eye. And they've briefly seen, they've glimpsed that other version of that person. But that's more of a positive experience. Or I guess it can be startling in some situations, but it's not a scary or a negative thing. Not like this idea that David Icke presents, that the reptilians are trying to take over governments and people in positions of power. I have not found any indication that reptilians are really interested in our governmental structures or anything like that. They're more interested in sticking to their own, the people who already have some kind of a soul connection to them or who have a family history of interaction with that particular group, and not so much interested in government or celebrities or anyone like that.
Well, it's going to be interesting, because soon there will be a documentary out called Don't Mention the Reptilians, which yourself, myself, David Icke, Ellis Taylor, Mary Rodwell, the list goes on and on, which I'm actually looking forward to seeing, like a collection of a lot of these experiences and researches all banged into one thing. And apparently now it's going to be, you know, three movies or something like that, because it was so big, which I'm actually looking forward to, because I think it's something you can point someone towards to straight away and go, well, check this out, because here's all different things on this subject, and make of it what you will from the research and that sort of thing. So that's something where people will be able to get a wider collection, I guess, of a lot of this stuff. But talking about the abduction phenomena, I've been having experiences, I guess, probably since 1990. I'm almost 32 now, so I haven't been researching it that long, and I didn't know what the hell I was saying when my stuff started. But talking to a lot of experiences or abductees now, what I find is, in time, through their own experiences and their own knowledge, is maybe not so much an abduction, but an agreement on another level. Not saying that's the case in all cases, but that's sort of what I found as a commonality. Like, we look at... you mentioned Bud Hopkins, he had Intruders and Missing Time. They were very big books. Whitley Strieber's Communion. A lot of work by, other workers, researchers like John Mack, Bud Hop, John Mack, David Jacobs, many going throughout. There seems to be a mixed bag in the research, and some people attract like-minded cases. So somebody might attract very positive cases, somebody might attract very negative cases, and then you've got people that get both. And it's weird how this whole thing works, but what's your take on abductions being actual abductions, or do you think in a lot of cases there is sort of this soul agreement or an agreement type thing that they work out later on is really the case?
Well, I think it's very, very complex phenomenon. A lot of my ideas about the abduction phenomenon, in addition to, of course, reading Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and Whitley Strieber's books, you know, and then watching, actually, in 1993, I attended a Triad UFO Research Conference in Bellevue, Washington, where John Carpenter spoke on the subject of multiple participant abductions, in which he talked about abductions that involve two or more people simultaneously, and how even if they share, they both may share a period of missing time and not recall anything other than a UFO sighting they had, but then like maybe 10 or 20 years later, they'll each go to a hypnotherapist, and if they're living in different cities at the time, they'll each, one of them might go to John Carpenter and one to David Jacobs, and they'll be regressed to that incident, and they'll both come out with the same scenario, each told from their own point of view, with specific correlations in terms of what they remember, the sequence of events, and so forth. Which, to me, is evidence in favor of the efficacy of hypnosis. But, of course, we also know there are cases where there seems to be confabulation under hypnosis, where people can maybe recall events that did not happen, or the events are distorted. And it's very tricky, because conscious memory can be distorted, and that's particularly true with screen memories and abductions, but then hypnotic recall can sometimes be distorted or confabulated, as they say, as well. So getting to the truth is difficult, and each abduction researcher has kind of their own bias in terms of their worldview and what they expect to find, and then what they've found in the past and decided is an important aspect of the phenomenon. I have A Dual Soul Connection by Susie Hansen. This one just came out recently, and it talks about, she's an experiencer from New Zealand, and it talks about her lifetime of interaction with the Greys, and her feeling is generally positive, and she actually realizes she has a Grey soul as well as a human soul. David Jacobs, which just came out recently, and this one is called Walking Among Us, and it is Walking Among Us, the Alien Plan to Control Humanity, because David Jacobs sees what the aliens are doing as kind of a plan to take over our civilization through infiltration. What David Jacobs has come up with, I believe, fairly strong evidence that many abductees are training these human-looking late-generation hybrids to actually live among us as human beings. And so I do believe that, yes, this integration thing appears to be going on with some hybrids learning to live here. And if it's a global phenomenon, then the hybrids could be being put in place all over the planet, but I don't find any evidence to suggest that this is part of a takeover. I think it could just be pure integration for the purpose of kind of passing on their genes or creating a way to interact with us more on their level, because I don't think humans and aliens, greys, reptilians, whatever, necessarily interact very well currently. But if we had some beings with mixed genetics and more telepathic ability, living among us as part of our civilization, and then if they're interbreeding with us, it could be that it's a complete merging where it's just an evolution of our species with the something closer to where the ETs, the aliens, are in terms of how they operate. And of course, I was also heavily influenced by Dan Wright, who headed up the MUFON Abduction Transcription Project from 1992 to 1997, in which he solicited tapes of hypnosis sessions and interviews from 19 or 20 different therapists and researchers who were doing regression work. And based on the transcriptions of those tapes, they found many commonalities, but they found also differences in that some of the beings would use a ramp, and they would have the ship would land, and the abductee would walk up a ramp. Other beings would just levitate the person out through the ceiling, and they'd pass right through the ceiling or a window and go up a beam of light. Some of the aliens seemed to always hover above the ground, even on board their ships, whereas others would actually walk. So there seemed to be wide disparities in terms of the technology or the level of psychic development of the different ET groups. So it points to the idea that we're dealing with multiple groups of entities, and there are even suggestions that some of them were working at cross purposes with each other. For instance, one abductee might have a regular group that comes to them and a particular sort of environment aboard the ship. And then later on, they would have an experience, this once or twice, where some different group of beings whose ships and look completely different and whose biology looks different, and these beings might pick them up and treat them more harshly and might be actually trying to figure out what their main group of beings is doing, extract information from them or something like that. It's like these different groups of ETs are working against each other. One's trying to keep its operation secret from the other one or something along those lines. So David Jacobs' view is that it's just one group doing one thing, and that it's bad for the human future because it represents a loss of sovereignty and freedom. Mm-hmm. As an alien civilization is going to take over our civilization. But I find there's so many different possibilities of what's going on with different groups of ETs that it's probably more complex than that, and I don't actually see any single group that's so powerful that seems to have a negative agenda. There are certainly some individuals among the ETs, the aliens, who've expressed a dislike for humans before, like, oh, I don't want to deal with you, I don't like you, or that kind of thing. But I don't think that kind of individual or dislike or maybe one small group of ETs might just generally treat humans harshly, but I don't see any evidence for an overall negative in terms of what the aliens are doing with the abduction phenomenon.
Well, we see the Brookings report where they reported, basically there'll be a takeover if we came across a higher evolved civilization. But again, like you said, there's multiple races here at play, and one thing that I've said to people is that if either, just say there were two sides of those, positive or negative, again, it depends on how you, like you were talking about, our worldview outlook, and I've had Mary Rodwell on, and she's a good friend, where she spoke about how if there's a parasitic weed that's got to live off a tree trunk, now, the only thing it knows to do is to live off that trunk. Now, to the tree, it might be negative because it's taking that life from it, but that's the only way it knows to survive. So that, from that point of view, it's not negative. But if we look at either side, good or negative, like, even though I see it more service or self-service, if one side was going to win, it would have happened by now. So this is where we could go down so many routes with this type of thing, but it is multi-layered, and it's just not one race, like you're saying, and it goes very complicated and a lot of loopholes. But with your research, we can look at the starseed scenario. Have you found people that are outside that scenario in terms of people being taken, and they've just got no clue in time why they've been taken? It's not connected to a soul group scenario. have you come across anything that's just been out of the blue in terms of, I've never heard this before, in terms of why this person's been taken?
I don't know. You know, everyone, I find that talking to experiencers, everyone, you know, you deal with people from all over the world, from every level of education. And of course, I communicate in English. And for some people, English is a second language, or there are people who are not very articulate. And so there are limitations both on what people know, because some people only remember a little bit of their experience. And there are limitations on how well I'm able to ask them questions and get them to answer in a way I can understand. So it's hard to say, but there are definitely, well, there's a case called a man named Ken Bakeman, who's written a book called The Verges. And he used to have a website, and he occasionally tries to put that back up, but it seems like it gets hacked and so forth. But he's had a lifetime of experiences, none of which he remembered until, because he's been having these since like the late 50s or the 60s when he was a child, but not until like the mid 90s after a car accident did he actually start having conscious memory of these things. But his experiences involved interacting with a particular reptilian that he calls Renjek, which is, you know, basically a phonetic pronunciation from the telepathic communication with Renjek. Renjek was basically his partner, and together they would they were working for a group of greys, but Renjek was sort of a mercenary. The greys were basically these beings, sort of an enforcement to keep what they regarded as unauthorized ETs from interacting here with the human, basically the Earth biohabitats. They don't want just any ET coming here and just doing any old thing. And in Ken Bakeman's experiences, he's encountered all sorts of different renegades, who were, there was a case of one being who was a sperm merchant who was apparently taking human reproductive material to sell somewhere in some other worlds somewhere. There were beings who were here to use things like drugs and alcohol that we have here, or to just have different kinds of experiences that they can't have in their own world. But excuse me, there many different reasons that they come here. Just so Ken, I spoke to, I met him in the late 90s. I actually met him through John Rhodes' website, reptoids.com, and John Rhodes was one of the first people to talk about the reptilians. He always prefers the term reptoids, which is short for reptilian humanoid. And John Rhodes had a website starting into earlier mid-90s, and he used to have a group on there. And then in the late 90s, I met Ken Bakeman there, and then I met Ken Bakeman in person, I think back in 99, and I met him two or three times, and one time we spent like 2 hours or more together talking face-to-face at a bookstore, and Ken really convinced me that in spite of how bizarre his memories are, that these are genuine memories of what he recalls, what has come forward. Not so much through regression in his case, but actually he would start with, he would see maybe something on television that would trigger a flashback, and then he would sit down and kind of almost regress himself and try to write down everything that's coming to him. And he would come up with these experiences. And I have a strong feeling that some of his experiences have probably distortions in terms of what actually happens. Just because some of them are really so bizarre. But that's a case that's definitely, if anyone wants a broad sampling of different kinds of reasons that aliens might be coming here, to look into his case.
No, that's something new to me, like that case as well. So in terms of being a researcher in that, one thing I'd like to ask you, and one thing that I've found talking to a lot of researchers myself, is that we do have people sometimes lying or exaggerating about their experiences, their cases, whether they're trying to do that or it just happens, who knows. But one thing I found that's really weird is that from what I've done and talking to others now when I pose this question to them, is that some people actually hold back on what really happened because it's so far out. It's like, remember how I told you about this experience? Well, I didn't tell you this part because I thought you'd think I'm friggin' nuts. Have you come across that a fair bit?
I have come across that. It's, you know, I find, for instance, on Facebook, I'll go into some group and there's someone posting all this stuff on conspiracy theories and different UFO videos, some of which are quite questionable and look like they may be CGI and don't have any background investigation on them. And why is this person so driven? And then, you know, later on, I'll talk to this person privately and I'll ask them, okay, what did you experience? And they'll come out with this really fascinating alien encounter experience. But they say, well, I'm, you know, I don't think anyone's going to believe me if I share my own experience. So they're driven to share all this other stuff, a lot of which may be completely bogus, but they are too reluctant to come forward and say exactly what it is that they've experienced. But it's through people's own experiences that we're going to find the answers to this phenomenon, not all these beliefs they have about these conspiracies or these questionable UFO videos and so forth. And I wish, I don't know how to encourage people to, I just tell people, please just tell me what you experienced, and I'm not going to judge you. I've heard it all before, and maybe there's some things I haven't heard before, but you know, I'm not going to dismiss anything. I'm going to listen and try to find out, you know, if it's something completely new to me, it goes into my gray basket, which is kind of a term I borrowed from Stanton Friedman. He's got his stuff. He knows this is definitely, he feels it's legit. The stuff he feels is fake or bogus, and then he's got this other category, calls it gray basket, for, well, I've heard this from one or two cases, but it's somewhat questionable, so I'm going to wait till I have additional confirmation. And it's important for all researchers to have a large gray basket where we don't dismiss it, but we don't necessarily accept it as being, oh yes, that's the answer, that's what's really going on.
It's a very valid and important point, because I think I got a few grey baskets because I filled them up a few times, but there has been times where, in time, either through my own experiences or talking to people like yourself, I've gone, this makes sense now. This that I thought was totally full of crap now has something bearing on it because, you know, of something else that happened. So this is where I say to a lot of people, sometimes things are absolutely ridiculous, but a lot of the time I'm putting things straight in that grey basket now, because 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the track, it might have some validity to it. Somebody I actually love to listen to and have looked at a lot of stuff of his work is John Lear. And, you know, look at the 80s, and it's like his ufology's crazy grandpa, and I love him to death. I reckon he's an absolutely fantastic bloke. But not everything, but there's some things he was saying in the 80s when he hooked up with George Knapp doing shows and whatnot, after the Bob Lazar or before the Bob Lazar thing, that he said, you know, even about the NSA and Pine Gap, there's some things that have come out to be public knowledge that you're gone, you know, either he was in the loop or he was ahead of his time, because some of that's, you know, become fact down the track. So I think the grey basket scenario is a very important point. In saying that, have you had any experiences yourself from doing the researching that you've been doing?
Well, I used to be able to say probably not. In 1992, when I was in college, November 92, and in the past couple years, I've found other people had interesting experiences and right around that same time frame. But I did have a shadow person experience, which, you know, I've always kind of just said, okay, that's a sleep paralysis episode. And to this day, I still kind of consider it possibly just that sleep paralysis thing, which is like where the mind is awake, but the body's still asleep. In any case, that involved, I was just lying in my bed in my dorm room in the afternoon, and I glanced into the mirror, which was next to the foot of the bed on the back of my door, and I saw in the mirror a shadowy black human-like figure, like about the size of a man, just looking like a man. It wasn't wearing a hat. It wasn't wearing a cloak or anything like that. It's just a nondescript man-like figure that was completely black, and I was like studying it. I looked at its face, and I saw it didn't have a face. It had what I describe as black charcoal smudges over black construction paper. It was just a hint of a smudginess to it. And I was like asking, because back at that time, it was around the time when I was reading Whitley Strieber's probably Transformation, and that might have been you had probably David Jacobs' book Secret Life, which had just come out. I was wondering, okay, is this me being returned from an abduction experience, or is this an ET coming to check up on me? But why does it look like a black figure instead of like one of those little gray things that they write about in all the books? And so I tried to turn onto my side so I could look over to where it was standing across the room from me based on where the reflection was in the mirror, and I discovered I was paralyzed, and at that moment I became scared. But then it seems like a moment later I was able to move. I looked and there was nothing there, and I just kind of dismissed it as a sleep paralysis episode, and to this day that's still kind of what it is. And for a long time, that was my most vivid sort of paranormal kind of experience. But then just 1 month ago, at the my second Experiencer Speak conference that I attended, which was actually the fourth conference they've held, and they hold these in Portland, Maine. This year it was end of August, and afterwards, some of the attendees, particularly the speakers, are invited to go to a lake house in Maine and stay with some of the hosts of the conference. And so I stayed there for a few days, and on September 3rd of this year, there was next to this lake house, just a short distance away, there's a gully with a creek in it, and it's a heavily wooded area, Audrey Starborn, who's kind of the organizer behind the conference, she called us out of the house onto the deck and said, listen to this, look at this, and we were hearing all this cracking in the woods, and we looked, and there was a tree falling down, but it was coming down in stages, and it was bending and bending, and it was as if there was an invisible force pulling it down. And I was thinking, well, I've never seen a tree come down before, so maybe this is just how it happens. If it looked like a perfectly healthy tree, but maybe inside it was rotted or something. So I was trying to rationalize and explain why this is happening and what I'm seeing. And then Audrey and her twin sister Debbie and I went down to the rim of this gully, and we looked through the trees, and we didn't want to get any closer because of the risk of having actually a tree fall on us, which is something I wanted to avoid. But we were seeing what looked like invisible beings, maybe like climbing in the top of this tree like a gorilla. And how did we see that? Well, we saw the movement of the branches and leaves that they were creating. And so I was trying to explain this. This was around, it was in about 135, 140 when we initially noticed the tree coming down. And then this was about 150 to 2 o'clock that we were observing this.
Was this during the day?
This was during the day. Yeah. This was just midday. Mm-hmm. There'd been a little bit of rain earlier in the day, but basically it was a fairly warm, mostly sunny day with, a little bit of humidity, and the air was pretty still. We were observing what looked like creatures moving in the tree, but there was nothing visible there as far as any kind of creatures that could be causing this movement. And I was thinking, okay, what's happening is the tree is coming down, it's getting caught on something, it's slipping, or a branch breaks and it moves a little bit further. And each time, one of the lower branches we can't see must be jostling other branches of trees nearby, causing this movement that looks like an animal moving around. And Debbie seemed like she was getting communication from these invisible beings. And then at some point shortly after two, Debbie says, well, I guess the show's over for now, or some words to that effect. And so we'd go back up to the house, and Debbie and I are working on some drawings and so forth. And then my friends Lee and Raquel, who are there, while Debbie and I are on the deck, and this is, you know, after 3 o'clock now, Debbie and I are working on these drawings. Lee and Raquel start going down into the gully, and they're observing something at close range. And when Lee initially goes down by himself, after Raquel kind of goes down with him and leaves him there to observe this, Lee comes running out of the woods, cussing really loudly. And then Raquel takes him down there, tells him to stop being so jumpy, you know. But, you know, it kind of raised my curiosity about what did Lee see down there. And so about 4:20 p.m., I go down there and Debbie follows me, and we are all sitting near what's now where the tree is lying horizontally, the initial tree that we saw coming down. And so the top of the tree is now like bushes in front of us, because it's lying across the gully. We are observing at close range, me only 2 or 3 feet away, movements of these leaves that, you know, if you're walking in the woods and you hear a rustle and you look and you see a movement in the leaves there or the branches, you know if it's something that's caused by an animal. You know, if it's just the wind, you get that gentle swaying movement, but this was definitely an animal causing this. I'm looking for the animal, and there's no animal there. So it was like some kind of invisible thing was causing the leaves to move, and it was even seemed to be reacting to us. We would move closer to it, we would ask it to touch us. We never did feel it touch us, although Debbie felt something on her head, but I think that may be more of a psychic thing. Mm-hmm. She'd have to speak to that herself. But it felt like a very positive experience. It was like it seemed curious about us, and it was announcing itself to us, and it may have been, you know, I don't know. Raquel had the feeling it was like one consciousness or one being, but we, at the same time, we would see movements in different areas of the branches simultaneously. My feeling, just based on mostly observing the movement, was that it was maybe one or two large things that were ape-like in the sense they were moved like, and they were about the size of a chimpanzee, I would guess. And then there were smaller ones that were more like monkey-like, but just based on the different kinds of movements I was seeing. But it's exactly as if you took a nature video showing apes and monkeys playing in a tree and digitally removed the apes and monkeys, leaving only the movement of the branches. And we observed this for about 40 minutes until, you know, the activity seemed to slow down, and Debbie relayed the message that these beings, they have to go home now, or they need a break or something like this. And then we came up out of the gully, and that is my most profound, awesome, I mean, my only real, fully unambiguous paranormal experience I've ever had. And I am happy to say I was able to share it with some other people, and so we can all kind of confirm each other's experience of that event. Looking back on it, you know, we did not hear any breathing. We did not hear any vocalizations, and we did not smell any odor from any biological entity there. So I think it wasn't simply an invisible creature or creatures. Now, if it had been, you would think you might have heard some breathing or smelled something, because we were only a couple feet away from this. I think if it was invisibility, it was perfect invisibility, because people talk about seeing a ripple in the air, or they talk about seeing a silhouette, or in the movie Predator, you remember you could kind of see a distortion where the being was. In this case, we saw nothing.
Was there any change in the background environment? Like, in terms of, bugs, insects, birds, anything go dead silent?
No, I've heard this in other cases where when some paranormal phenomenon or an alien or a UFO shows up, then suddenly all the animals go silent. In this case, we did not notice anything. At least I didn't notice. It seemed like there were birds chirping the whole time. I don't recall any insects, but if there were, you know, I don't think they stopped for this. So it's like whatever these invisible things were, it's like the rest of the creatures there were totally comfortable with them being there. It was just perfect invisibility. But my feeling is that it's actually something else, that it's more of an interdimensional thing. For example, there was a case, one of the first cases of a reptilian I got. This is a gentleman who was a hypnotherapist. I interviewed him about this a couple times in 1994, and he talked about an experience with a reptilian, a female reptilian that we name Ruby, who has ruby red eyes. And I don't remember exactly how she got the name Ruby, but I think it probably was due to the color of her eyes. And so he was, he talked about an experience a couple years earlier, probably early 90s, where he was doing a regression on a female abductee, as best I recall the story. The abductee was like sitting on the chair or the couch in front of him. And he was asking questions, and then he noticed in the abductee's arm was actually, he saw the skin sink in where there was the impression of a five-fingered hand holding her arm. But there was no sense of anyone there as far as smelling someone or something like that. And then like a moment later, the hand let go. And a moment later, this being in a monk's robe with its head bowed and its arms folded across its chest just materializes in front of him, and at that point there's a crackle of static electricity, there's a rush of air as if this being is becoming solid in our three-dimensional reality, and all the air that was in that spot was being displaced, and there's suddenly, in this case, an odor of like rotten meat, unpleasant odor, and then the being pulls back the hood. Well, he asks, are you a master teacher? And the being says in a gravelly voice, which I believe in this case was actually out loud and not telepathic, you may address me as such. And then he asks, are you of the light, Christ light? And the being just remains silent. And it seems like there's kind of an adversarial thing happening, and then the being pulls back the hood and opens up the robe, and it's basically a very muscular reptilian wearing a vest who then says in a threatening manner, you cannot fight what you cannot see. And he had the sense that this reptilian was kind of had some interest in this abductee and resented the fact that he was doing this regression on the abductee. Perhaps this is part of the abductee's star family, or this reptilian has a sense that this is reptilian belongs to her, or that the abductee belongs to her. But so this was a female reptilian, so in spite of her being muscular and so forth, she had really beautiful coloration of the scales around the eyes, including like bright yellow rims to the eyelids, and aqua blue color between the scales of the lower eyelids. In any case, the reptilian was looking for a fear response from this hypnotherapist, and then the hypnotherapist was being very conscious not to give that response and rather just studying this reptilian, and I believe he stood up and kind of faced her, and then I think at that point the reptilian just disappeared and was gone. That's about how that encounter went down, but the important thing about that to me, besides what it might tell us about reptilians, is that the way before the reptilian materialized. It seemed to be there in some kind of invisible states, but it wasn't physically manifest, and yet it could interact. It could physically interact by pushing its hand into the woman's arm, leaving an actual physical impression, as if surfaces of that reptilian's body could interact with surfaces in our world just by an act of will. And that, of course, also ties into things like when people actually see the grays walk through walls, they seem to be able to selectively interact with physical objects, like they can walk through the wall, or I know a case where a woman saw beings around her standing. She'd woken up out of a dream in which the aliens were interacting with her, and then the aliens were standing around her bed, but some of the aliens were actually, their bodies seemed to be superimposed through her bed, and yet one was holding onto her arm, and definitely very physically they're holding her arm. So it's like an interdimensional sort of state. They can selectively interact with objects in our three-dimensional reality, and that, I think, is what we saw in those plants, that whatever these beings were, and I had the feeling that they were intelligent, they were curious, and they were just announcing themselves to us. And it was a very positive experience for all of us involved, but I feel it's more of what we would call an interdimensional thing rather than some form of perfect invisibility technology. But of course, it's just a guess, because maybe if it's some kind of being that doesn't breathe or doesn't breathe loudly, or it's still possible it was some sort of invisible being. So I don't know for sure.
So a little bit of an experience for you.
Yes, definitely.
And there's nothing like sharing something like that with other people as well, just to be able to cross-correlate things and share things and stuff like that, just for validation and, measuring things up, is there? It's something that's quite different from when it's just, experiencing something one-on-one.
Definitely. This is my first really unambiguous UFO, I think it's UFO related in some way, but I can't necessarily say that. But I do feel it happened because of Audrey and Debbie Starborn, and because of their connection with UFO occupants and the various sorts of beings you start interacting with when you're interacting with UFO occupants. But definitely, I feel because I shared this with other people, and because we were not in some state where there was no evidence of missing time as far as we can see, because we remember basically a 40-minute experience, and when we checked our watch, it lasted 40 minutes, no more than that. So, for that was the part of it when I was down in the gully anyway, it was about 40 minutes. But the events were going on throughout the whole afternoon, and actually even into the evening. But yeah, since I had a fully conscious experience without any real fear, other than initially there was some concern about the tree possibly coming down on me, but I very carefully went into the gully, kept an eye on the tree, okay, if it's going to come down, where is it going to come down, and so forth. Because there was some concern that these invisible beings might shake the tree so much that they would knock it down, and actually Lee and Raquel, when they initially reached out to the beings and asked the beings to touch them, the beings seemed to pull back further as if they were kind of startled by this, and it created a bunch of shaking, and one of the branches, one of the big heavy branches or part of a tree, did actually slide a bit further, and that kind of startled them, but no one was harmed, and because it was fully conscious, because it lasted several hours, and because there were multiple people who had essentially the same perception of events with subtle differences in terms of how we describe things or different kinds of movements we may have noticed, I feel confident that I can talk about this as it was an unambiguous paranormal experience. I'm not going to convince my parents, however. I think my dad thinks it was, my initial impression was that it was the tree coming down and slipping and catching and then slipping a little more, maybe a branch breaks, and the branches we couldn't see underneath all these leaves were somehow jostling the leaves or something like that. And my dad still assumes it's that. It's like the tree coming down and settling. But once I got down there within a few feet and had that big movement when the being seems to jump or something and basically announces itself to me from within a few feet away, I knew this is only the kind of movement that can be caused by an animal, but there was no animal.
Yeah, unexplained and a bit trippy. All right, well, David, we'll wrap it up there. I'd love to stay in contact with you. It's been a pleasure having you on and just sharing some of your experiences and research into the paranormal unknown and reptilian side of things. So, again, thank you, and we'll stay in touch, mate.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. Catch you later.